says nothing about other vital issues raised by its operations, from monopolistic and anti-competitive practices in the case of Amazon to pricing, tax strategies, and employment policies at Apple. Nor are there any guarantees for the future. Time will tell if Apple succumbs to surveillance capitalism, holds the line, or perhaps even expands its ambitions to anchor an effective alternative trajectory to a human future, aligned with the ideals of individual autonomy and the deepest values of a democratic society. One important implication of these distinctions is that even when our societies addressed capitalist harms produced by the tech companies, such as those related to monopoly or privacy, those actions do not ipso facto interrupt a firm's commitment to and continued elaboration of surveillance capitalism. For example, calls to break up Google or Facebook on monopoly grounds could easily result in establishing multiple surveillance capitalist firms, though at a diminished scale, and thus clear the way for more surveillance capitalist competitors. Similarly, reducing Google and Facebook's duopoly in online advertising does not reduce the reach of surveillance capitalism if online advertising market share is simply spread over 5 surveillance capitalist firms or 50 instead of 2. Throughout this book, I focus on the unprecedented aspects of surveillance capitalist operations that must be contested and interrupted if this market form is to be contained and vanquished. My focus in this book tends toward Google, Facebook, and Microsoft. The aim here is not a comprehensive critique of these companies as such. Instead, I view them as the petri dishes in which the DNA of surveillance capitalism is best examined. As I suggested earlier, my goal is to map a new logic and its operations, not a company or its technologies. I move across the boundaries of these and other companies in order to compile the insights that can flesh out the map, just as earlier observers moved across many examples to grasp the once new logics of managerial capitalism and mass production. It is also the case that surveillance capitalism was invented in the United States, in Silicon Valley, and at Google. This makes it an American invention which, like mass production, became a global reality. For this reason, much of this text focuses on developments in the U.S., although the consequences of these developments belong to the world. In studying the surveillance capitalist practices of Google, Facebook, Microsoft, and other corporations, I have paid close attention to the interviews, patents, earnings calls, speeches, conferences, videos, and company programs and policies. In addition, between 2012 and 2015, I interviewed 52 data scientists from 19 different companies with a combined 586 years of experience in high-technology corporations and startups, primarily in Silicon Valley. These interviews were conducted as I developed my ground-truth understanding of surveillance capitalism and its material infrastructure. Early on, I approached a small number of highly respected data scientists, senior software developers, and specialists in the Internet of Things. My interview sample grew as scientists introduced me to their colleagues. The interviews, sometimes over many hours, were conducted with the promise of confidentiality and anonymity, but my gratitude toward them is personal, and I publicly declare it here. Finally, throughout this book, you will read excerpts from W.H. Auden's Sonnets from China, along with the entirety of Sonnet 18. This cycle of Auden's poems is dear to me, a poignant exploration of humanity's mythic history, the perennial struggle against violence and domination, and the transcendent power of the human spirit and its relentless claim on the future. Part 1. The Foundations of Surveillance Capitalism. Chapter 2. August 9, 2011. Setting the Stage for Surveillance Capitalism. The dangers and the punishments grew greater, and the way back by angels was defended against the poet and the legislator. W. H. Auden, Sonnets from China, 2. On August 9, 2011, Three events separated by thousands of miles captured the bountiful prospects and gathering dangers of our emerging information civilization. First, Silicon Valley pioneer Apple promised a digital dream of new solutions to old economic and social problems, and finally surpassed ExxonMobil as the world's most highly capitalized corporation. Second, a fatal police shooting in London sparked extensive rioting across the city, engulfing the city in a wave of violent protests. A decade of explosive digital growth had failed to mitigate the punishing austerity of neoliberal economics and the extreme inequality that it produced. Too many people had come to feel excluded from the future, embracing rage and violence as their only remedies. Third, Spanish citizens asserted their rights to a human future when they challenged Google by demanding the right to be forgotten. This milestone alerted the world to how quickly the cherished dreams of a more just and democratic digital future were shading into nightmare, and it foreshadowed a global political contest over the fusion of digital capabilities and capitalist ambitions. We relive that August day every day as in some ancient fable, doomed to retrace this looping path, until the soul of our information civilization is finally shaped by democratic action, private power, ignorance, or drift. 1. The Apple Hack. Apple thundered onto the music scene in the midst of a pitched battle between demand and supply. On one side were young people whose enthusiasm for Napster and other forms of music file sharing expressed a new quality of demand. Consumption my way. What I want, when I want it, where I want it. On the other side were music industry executives who chose to instill fear and to crush that demand by hunting down and prosecuting some of Napster's most ardent users. Apple bridged the divide with a commercially and legally viable solution that aligned the company with the changing needs of individuals while working with industry incumbents. Napster hacked the music industry, but Apple appeared to have hacked capitalism. It is easy to forget just how dramatic Apple's hack really was. The company's profits soared largely on the strength of its iPod, iTunes, iPhone sales. Bloomberg Businessweek described Wall Street analysts as befuddled by this mysterious Apple miracle. As one gushed, "We can't even model out some of the possibilities. It's like a religion." Even today, the figures are staggering. 3 days after the launch of the Windows-compatible iTunes platform in October 2003, listeners downloaded 1 million copies of the free iTunes software and paid for 1 million songs, prompting Steve Jobs to announce, "In less than 1 week, we've broken every record and become the largest online music company in the world." Within a month, there were 5 million downloads, then 10 million 3 months later, then 25 million 3 months after that. 4.5 years later, in January 2007, that number rose to 2 billion. And 6 years later, in 2013, it was 25 billion. In 2008, Apple surpassed Walmart as the world's largest music retailer. iPod sales were similarly spectacular, exploding from 1 million units per month after the music store's launch to 100 million less than 4 years later, when Apple subsumed the iPod's functions in its revolutionary iPhone, which drove another step function of growth. A 2017 study of stock market returns concluded that Apple had generated more profit for investors than any other U.S. company in the previous century. 100 years before the iPod, mass production provided the gateway to a new era, when it revealed a parallel universe of economic value hidden in new and still poorly understood mass consumers who wanted goods, but at a price they could afford. Henry Ford reduced the price of an automobile by 60% with a revolutionary industrial logic that combined high volume and low unit cost. He called it mass production, summarized in his famous maxim, "You can have any color car you want so long as it's black." Later, GM's Alfred Sloan expounded on that principle. By the time we have a product to show them, consumers, we are necessarily committed to selling that product because of the tremendous investment involved in bringing it to market. The music industry's business model was built on telling its consumers what they would buy, just like Ford and Sloan. Executives invested in the production and distribution of CDs, and it was the CD that customers would have to purchase. Henry Ford was among the first to strike gold by tapping into the new mass consumption with the Model T. As in the case of the iPod, Ford's Model T factory was pressed to meet the immediate explosion of demand. Mass production could be applied to anything, and it was. It changed the framework of production as it diffused throughout the economy and around the world, and it established the dominance of a new mass production capitalism as the basis for wealth creation in the 20th century. The iPod iTunes innovations flipped this century-old industrial logic, leveraging the new capabilities of digital technologies to invert the consumption experience. Apple rewrote the relationship between listeners and their music with a distinct commercial logic that, while familiar to us now, was also experienced as revolutionary when first introduced. The Apple inversion depended on a few key elements. Digitalization made it possible to rescue valued assets, in this case songs, from the institutional spaces in which they were trapped. The costly institutional procedures that Sloan had described were eliminated in favor of a direct route to listeners. In the case of the CD, for example, Apple bypassed the physical production of the product along with its packaging, inventory, storage, marketing, transportation, distribution, and physical retailing. The combination of the iTunes platform and the iPod device made it possible for listeners to continuously reconfigure their songs at will. No two iPods were the same, and an iPod one week was different from the same iPod another week as listeners decided and redecided the dynamic pattern. It was an excruciating development for the music industry and its satellites, retailers, marketers, etc. But it was exactly what the new listeners wanted. How should we understand this success? Apple's miracle is typically credited to its design and marketing genius. Consumers' eagerness to have what I want, when, where, and how I want it is taken as evidence of the demand for convenience, and sometimes even written off as narcissism or petulance. In my view, these explanations pale against the unprecedented magnitude of Apple's accomplishments. We have contented ourselves for too long with the superficial explanations of Apple's unprecedented fusion of capitalism and the digital, rather than digging deeper into the historical forces that summoned this new form to life. Just as Ford tapped into a new mass consumption, Apple was among the first to experience explosive commercial success by tapping into a new society of individuals and their demand for individualized consumption. The inversion implied a larger story of a commercial reformation in which the digital era finally offered the tools to shift the focus of consumption from the mass to the individual, liberating and reconfiguring capitalism's operations and assets. It promised something utterly new, urgently necessary, and operationally impossible outside the networked spaces of the digital. Its implicit promise of an advocacy-oriented alignment with our new needs and values was a confirmation of our inner sense of dignity and worth, ratifying the feeling that we matter. In offering consumers respite from an institutional world that was indifferent to their individual needs, it opened the door to the possibility of a new rational capitalism, able to reunite supply and demand by connecting us to what we really want in exactly the ways that we choose. As I shall argue in the coming chapters, the same historical conditions that sent the iPod on its wild ride summoned the emancipatory promise of the Internet into our everyday lives as we sought remedies for inequality and exclusion. Of most significance for our story, these same conditions would provide important shelter for surveillance capitalism's ability to root and flourish. More precisely, The Apple miracle and surveillance capitalism each owes its success to the destructive collision of two opposing historical forces. One vector belongs to the longer history of modernization and the centuries-long societal shift from the mass to the individual. The opposing vector belongs to the decades-long elaboration and implementation of the neoliberal economic paradigm, its political economics, its transformation of society, and especially its aim to reverse, subdue, impede, and even destroy the individual urge towards psychological self-determination and moral agency. The next sections briefly sketch the basic contours of this collision, establishing terms of reference that we will return to throughout the coming chapters as we explore surveillance capitalism's rapid rise to dominance. 2. The two modernities. Capitalism evolves in response to the needs of people in a time and place. Henry Ford was clear on this point. Mass production begins in the perception of a public need. At a time when the Detroit automobile manufacturers were preoccupied with luxury vehicles, Ford stood alone in his recognition of a nation of newly modernizing individuals. Farmers, wage earners, and shopkeepers, who had little and wanted much, but at a price they could afford. Their demand issued from the same conditions of existence that summoned Ford and his men as they discovered the transformational power of a new logic of standardized, high-volume, low-unit cost production. Ford's famous $5 day was emblematic of a systematic logic of reciprocity. In paying assembly line workers higher wages than anyone had yet imagined, he recognized that the whole enterprise of mass production rested upon a thriving population of mass consumers. Although the market form and its bosses had many failings and produced many violent facts, its populations of newly modernizing individuals were valued as the necessary sources of customers and employees. It depended upon its communities in ways that would eventually lead to a range of institutionalized reciprocities. On the outside, the drama of access to affordable goods and services was bound by democratic measures and methods of oversight that asserted and protected the rights and safety of workers and consumers. On the inside were durable employment systems, career ladders, and steady increases in wages and benefits. Indeed, considered from the vantage point of the last 40 years, during which this market form was systematically deconstructed, its reciprocity with the social order, however vexed and imperfect, appears to have been one of its most salient features. The implication is that new market forms are most productive when they are shaped by an allegiance to the actual demands and mentalities of people. The great sociologist Emile Durkheim made this point at the dawn of the 20th century, and his insight will be a touchstone for us throughout this book. Observing the dramatic upheavals of industrialization in his time, factories, specialization, the complex division of labor, Durkheim understood that although economists could describe these developments, they could not grasp their cause. He argued that these sweeping changes were caused by the changing needs of people, and that economists were, and remain, systematically blind to these social facts. He wrote, "The division of labor appears to us otherwise than it does to economists. For them, it essentially consists in greater production. For us, this greater productivity is only a necessary consequence, a repercussion of the phenomenon. If we specialize, it is not to produce more, but it is to enable us to live in the new conditions of existence that have been made for us." The sociologist identified the perennial human quest to live effectively in our conditions of existence as the invisible, casual power that summons the division of labor, technologies, work organization, capitalism, and ultimately civilization itself. Each is forged in the same crucible of human need that is produced by what Durkheim called the always intensifying violence of the struggle for effective life. If work becomes more divided, it is because the struggle for existence is more acute. The rationality of capitalism reflects this alignment, however imperfect, with the needs that people experience as they try to live their lives effectively, struggling with the conditions of existence that they encounter in their time and place. When we look through this lens, we can see that those eager customers for Ford's incredible Model T and the new consumers of iPods and iPhones are expressions of the conditions of existence that characterized their era. In fact, each is the fruit of distinct phases of a centuries-long process known as individualization that is the human signature of the modern era. Ford's mass consumers were members of what has been called the first modernity. But the new conditions of the second modernity produced a new kind of individual for whom the Apple inversion and the many digital innovations that followed would become essential. This second modernity summoned the likes of Google and Facebook into our lives, and in an unexpected twist, helped to enable the surveillance capitalism that would follow. What are these modernities and how do they matter to our story? The advent of the individual as the locus of moral agency and choice initially occurred in the West, where the conditions for this emergence first took hold. First, let's establish that the concept of individualization should not be confused with the neoliberal ideology of individualism that shifts all responsibility for success or failure to a mythical, atomized, isolated individual, doomed to a life of perpetual competition and disconnected from relationships, community, and society. Neither does it refer to the psychological process of individuation that is associated with the lifelong exploration of self-development. Instead, individualization is a consequence of long-term processes of modernization. Until the last few minutes of human history, each life was foretold in blood and geography, sex and kin, rank and religion. I am my mother's daughter, I am my father's son. The sense of the human being as an individual emerged gradually over centuries, clawed from this ancient vice. Around 200 years ago, we embarked upon the first modern road where life was no longer handed down one generation to the next according to the traditions of village and clan. This first modernity marks the time when life became individualized for great numbers of people as they separated from traditional norms, meanings, and rules. That meant each life became an open-ended reality to be discovered rather than a certainty to be enacted. Even where the traditional world remains intact for many people today, it can no longer be experienced as the only possible story. I often think about the courage of my great-grandparents. What mixture of sadness, terror, and exhilaration did they feel when in 1908, determined to escape the torments of the Cossacks in their tiny village outside of Kiev, they packed their five children, including my four-year-old grandfather Max, and all their belongings into a wagon and pointed the horses toward a steamer bound for America. Like millions of other pioneers of this first modernity, they escaped a still feudal world and found themselves improvising a profoundly new kind of life. Max would later marry Sophie and build a family far from the rhythms of the villages that birthed them. The Spanish poet Antonio Machado captured the exhilaration and daring of these first modernity individuals in his famous song, "Traveler, there is no road. The road is made as you go." This is what search has meant. A journey of exploration and self-creation, not an instant swipe to already composed answers. Still, the new industrial society retained many of the hierarchical motifs of the older feudal world in its patterns of affiliation based on class, race, occupation, religion, ethnicity, sex, and the leviathans of mass society. Its corporations, workplaces, unions, churches, political parties, civic groups, and school systems. This new world order of the mass and its bureaucratic logic of concentration, centralization, standardization, and administration still provided solid anchors, guidelines, and goals for each life. Compared to their parents and all the generations before, Sophie and Max had to make things up on their own, but not everything. Sophie knew she would raise the family. Max knew he would earn their living. You adapted to what the world had on offer, and you followed the rules. Nor did anyone ask your opinion or listen if you spoke. You were expected to do what you were supposed to do, and little by little you made your way. You raised a nice family, and eventually you'd have a house, car, washing machine, and refrigerator. Mass production pioneers like Henry Ford and Alfred Sloan had found a way to get you these things at a price you could afford. If there was anxiety, it reflected the necessity of living up to the requirements of one's roles. One was expected to suppress any sense of self that spilled over the edges of the given social role, even at considerable psychic cost. Socialization and adaptation were the materials of a psychology and sociology that regarded the nuclear family as the factory for the production of personalities, ready-made for conformity to the social norms of mass society. Those factories also produced a great deal of pain. The feminine mystique, closeted homosexuals, church-going atheists, and back-alley abortions. Eventually, though, they even produced people like you and me. When I set out on the open road, there were few answers, nothing to emulate, no compass to follow except for the values and dreams that I carried inside me. I was not alone. The road was filled with so many others on the same kind of journey. The first modernity birthed us, but we brought a new mentality to life, a second modernity. What began as a modern migration from traditional lifeways bloomed into a new society of people born to a sense of psychological individuality with its double-edged birthright of liberation and necessity. We experience both the right and the requirement to choose our own lives. No longer content to be anonymous members of the mass, we feel our entitlement to self-determination. An obvious truth to us that would have been an impossible act of hubris for Sophie and Max. This mentality is an extraordinary achievement of the human spirit, even as it can be a life sentence to uncertainty, anxiety, and stress. Since the second half of the 20th century, the individualization story has taken this new turn toward a second modernity. Industrialization modernity, and the practices of mass production capitalism at its core, produced more wealth than had ever been imagined possible. Where democratic politics, distributional policies, access to education and healthcare, and strong civil society institutions complemented that wealth, a new society of individuals first began to emerge. Hundreds of millions of people gained access to experiences that had once been the preserve of a tiny elite. University education, travel, improved life expectancy, disposable income, rising standards of living, broad access to consumer goods, varied communication and information flows, and specialized, intellectually demanding work. The hierarchical social compact and mass society of the first modernity promised predictable rewards, but their very success was the knife that cut us loose and sent us tumbling onto the shores of the second modernity, propelling us toward more intricate and richly patterned lives. Education and knowledge work increased mastery of language and thought, the tools with which we create personal meaning and form our own opinions. Communication, information, consumption, and travel stimulated individual self-consciousness and imaginative capabilities, informing perspectives, values, and attitudes in ways that could no longer be contained by predefined roles or group identity. Improved health and longer lifespans provided the time for a self-life to deepen and mature, fortifying the legitimacy of personal identity over and against a priori social norms. Even when we revert to traditional roles, these are choices now rather than absolute truths imposed at birth. As the great clinician of identity, Erik Erikson, once described it, "The patient of today suffers most under the problem of what he should believe and who he should or might be or become." While the patient of early psychoanalysis suffered most under inhibitions which prevented him from being what and who he thought he knew he was. This new mentality has been most pronounced in wealthier countries, but research shows significant pluralities of second modernity individuals in nearly every region of the world. The first modernity suppressed the growth of expression of self in favor of collective solutions, but by the second modernity, the self is all we have. The new sense of psychological sovereignty broke upon the world long before the internet appeared to amplify its claims. We learn through trial and error how to stitch together our lives. Nothing is given. Everything must be reviewed, renegotiated, and reconstructed on the terms that make sense to us. Family, religion, sex, gender, morality, marriage, community, love, nature, social connections, political participation, career, food. Indeed, it was this new mentality and its demands that summoned the internet and the burgeoning information apparatus into our everyday lives. The burdens of life without a fixed destiny turned us toward the empowering, information-rich resources of the new digital milieu as it offered new ways to amplify our voices and forge our own chosen patterns of connection. So profound is this phenomenon that one can say without exaggeration that the individual, as the author of his or her own life, is the protagonist of our age, whether we experience this fact as emancipation or affliction. Western modernity had formed around a canon of principles and laws that confer inviolable individual rights and acknowledge the sanctity of each individual life. However, it was not until the second modernity that felt experience began to catch up with formal law. This felt truth has been expressed in new demands to make actual in everyday life what is already established in law. In spite of its liberating potential, the second modernity was slated to become a hard place to live, and our conditions of existence today reflect this trouble. Some of the challenges of the second modernity arise from the inevitable costs associated with the creation and sustenance of one's own life. But second modernity instability is also the result of institutionalized shifts in economic and social policies and practices associated with the neoliberal paradigm and its rise to dominance. This far-reaching paradigm has been aimed at containing, rechanneling, and reversing the secular wave of second modernity claims to self-determination and the habitats in which those claims can thrive. We live in this collision between a centuries-old story of modernization and a decades-old story of economic violence that thwarts our pursuit of effective life. There is a rich and compelling literature that documents this turning point in economic history, and my aim here is simply to call attention to some of the themes in this larger narrative that are vital to our understanding of the collision. The condition of existence that summoned both the Apple miracle and surveillance capitalism's subsequent gestation and growth. 3. The neoliberal habitat. The mid-1970s saw the post-war economic order under siege from stagnation, inflation, and sharply reduced growth, most markedly in the U.S. and the U.K. There were also new pressures on the political order as second modernity individuals, especially students, young workers, African Americans, women, Latinos, and other marginalized groups, mobilized around demands for equal rights, voice, and participation. In the U.S., the Vietnam War was a focal point of social unrest, and the corruption exposed by the Watergate scandal triggered public insistence on political reform. In the U.K., inflation had strained industrial relations beyond the breaking point. In both countries, the specter of apparently intractable economic decay, combined with vocal new demands on the democratic social compact, produced confusion, anxiety and desperation among elected officials ill-equipped to judge why once reliable Keynesian politics had failed to reverse the course. Neoliberal economists had been waiting in the wings for this opportunity, and their ideas flowed into the policy vacuum that now bedeviled both governments. Led by the Austrian economist Friedrich Hayek, fresh from his 1974 Nobel Prize, and his American counterpart Milton Friedman, who received the Nobel 2 years later, they had honed their radical free market economic theory, political ideology, and pragmatic agenda throughout the post-war period at the fringe of their profession, under the shadow of Keynesian domination. And now their time had come. The free market creed originated in Europe as a sweeping defense against the threat of totalitarian and communist collective ideologies. It aimed to revive acceptance of a self-regulating market as a natural force of such complexity and perfection that it demanded radical freedom from all forms of state oversight. Hayek explained the necessity of absolute individual and collective submission to the exacting disciplines of the market as an unknowable extended order that supersedes the legitimate political authority vested in the state. Modern economics explains how such an extended order constitutes an information-gathering process that no central planning agency, let alone any individual, could know as a whole, possess, or control. Hayek and his ideological brethren insisted on a capitalism stripped down to its raw core, unimpeded by any other force and impervious to any external authority. Inequality of wealth and rights was accepted and even celebrated as a necessary feature of a successful market system and as a force for progress. Hayek's ideology provided the intellectual superstructure and legitimation for a new theory of the firm that became another crucial antecedent to the surveillance capitalist corporation. Its structure, moral content, and relationship to society. The new conception was operationalized by economists Michael Jensen and William Meckling. Leaning heavily on Hayek's work, the two scholars took an axe to the pro-social principles of the 20th century corporation, an axe that became known as the shareholder value movement. In 1976, Jensen and Meckling published a landmark article in which they reinterpreted the manager as a sort of parasite feeding off the host of ownership, unavoidable perhaps, but nonetheless an obstacle to shareholder wealth. They boldly argued that structural disconnects between owners and managers can result in the value of the firm being substantially lower than it otherwise could be. If managers sub-optimized the value of the firm to its owners in favor of their own preferences and comfort, it was only rational for them to do so. The solution, these economists argued, was to assert the market's signal of value, the share price, as the basis for a new incentive structure intended to finally and decisively align managerial behavior with owners' interests. Managers who failed to bend to the ineffable signals of Hayek's extended order would quickly become prey to the barbarians at the gate in a new and vicious hunt for unrealized market value. In the crisis of democracy zeitgeist, the neoliberal vision and its reversion to market metrics was deeply attractive to politicians and policymakers, both as the means to evade political ownership of tough economic choices and because it promised to impose a new kind of order where disorder was feared. The absolute authority of market forces would be enshrined as the ultimate source of imperative control, displacing democratic contest and deliberation with an ideology of atomized individuals sentenced to perpetual competition for scarce resources. The disciplines of competitive markets promise to quiet unruly individuals and even transform them back into subjects too preoccupied with survival to complain. As the oldest collectivist enemies had receded, new ones took their place. State regulation and oversight, social legislation and welfare policies, labor unions and the institutions of collective bargaining, and the principles of democratic politics. Indeed, all these were to be replaced by the market's version of truth, and competition would be the solution to growth. The new aims would be achieved through supply-side reforms, including deregulation, privatization, and lower taxes. 35 years before Hayek and Friedman's ascendance, the great historian Karl Polanyi wrote eloquently on the rise of the market economy. Polanyi's studies led him to conclude that the operations of a self-regulating market are profoundly destructive when allowed to run free of countervailing laws and policies. He described the double movement, a network of measures and policies integrated into powerful institutions designed to check the action of the market relative to labor, land, and money. The double movement, Polanyi argued, supports the market form while tethering it to society, balancing, moderating, and mitigating its destructive excesses. Polanyi observed that such countermeasures emerged spontaneously in every European society during the second half of the 19th century. Each constructed legislative, regulatory, and institutional solutions to oversee contested new areas, such as workers' compensation, factory inspection, municipal trading, public utilities, food safety, child labor, and public safety. In the U.S., the double movement was achieved through decades of social contest that harnessed industrial production, however imperfectly, to society's needs. It appeared in the trust-busting, civil society, and legislative reforms of the Progressive Era. Later, it was elaborated in the legislative, juridical, social, and tax initiatives of the New Deal and the institutionalization of Keynesian economics during the post-World War II era, labor market, tax, and social welfare policies that ultimately increased economic and social equality. The double movement was further developed in the legislative initiatives of the Great Society, especially civil rights law and landmark environmental legislation. Many scholars credit such countermeasures with the success of market democracy in the U.S. and Europe, a political economics that proved far more adaptive in its ability to produce reciprocities of demand and supply than either leftist theories or even Polanyi had imagined. And by mid-century, the large corporation appeared to be a deeply rooted and durable modern social institution. The double movement was scheduled for demolition under the neoliberal flag, and implementation began immediately. In 1976, the same year that Jensen and Meckling published their path-breaking analysis, President Jimmy Carter initiated the first significant efforts to radically align the corporation with Wall Street's market metrics, targeting the airline, transportation, and financial sectors with a bold program of deregulation. What began as a ripple turned into a tidal wave that washed away controls from large segments of the economy in the last two decades of the 20th century. The implementation that began with Carter would define the Reagan and Thatcher eras, virtually every subsequent U.S. presidency, and much of the rest of the world, as the new fiscal and social policies spread to Europe and other regions in varying degrees. Thus began the disaggregation and diminishment of the U.S. public firm. The public corporation as a social institution was reinterpreted as a costly error, and its long-standing reciprocities with customers and employees were recast as destructive violations of market efficiency. Financial carrots and sticks persuaded executives to dismember and shrink their companies, and the logic of capitalism shifted from the profitable production of goods and services to increasingly exotic forms of financial speculation. The disciplines imposed by the new market operations stripped capitalism down to its raw core. And by 1989, Jensen confidently proclaimed the eclipse of the public corporation. By the turn of the century, as the foundational mechanisms of surveillance capitalism were just beginning to take shape, shareholder value maximization was widely accepted as the objective function of the firm. These principles, culled from a once extremist philosophy, were canonized as standard practice across commercial, financial, and legal domains. By 2000, U.S. public corporations employed fewer than half as many Americans as they did in 1970. In 2009, there were only half as many public firms as in 1997. The public corporation had become unnecessary for production, unsuited for stable employment and the provision of social welfare services, and incapable of proving a reliable long-term return on investment. In this process, the cult of the entrepreneur would rise to near mythic prominence as the perfect union of ownership and management, replacing the rich existential possibilities of the second modernity with a single glorified template of audacity, competitive cunning, dominance, and wealth. 4. The instability of the second modernity. On August 9, 2011, around the same time that cheers erupted in Apple's conference room, 16,000 police officers flooded the streets of London, determined to quell the most widespread and prolonged breakdown of order in London's history since the Gordon Riot of 1780. The rioting had begun four nights earlier when a peaceful vigil triggered by the police shooting of a young man suddenly turned violent. In the days that followed, the number of rioters swelled as looting and arson spread to 22 of London's 32 boroughs and other major cities across Britain. Over 4 days of street action, thousands of people caused property damage of over $50 million, and 3,000 people were arrested. Even as Apple's ascension appeared to ratify the claims of second modernity individuals, the streets of London told the grim legacy of a three-decade experiment in economic growth through exclusion. 1 week after the rioting, an article by sociologist Saskia Sassen in the Daily Beast observed that if there's one underlying condition, it has to do with the unemployment and bitter poverty among people who desire to be part of the middle class and who are keenly aware of the sharp inequality between themselves and their country's wealthy elite. These are in many ways social revolutions with a small r, protests against social conditions that have become unbearable. What were the social conditions that had become so unbearable? Many analysts agreed that the tragedy of Britain's riots was set into motion by neoliberalism's successful transformation of society, a program that was most comprehensively executed in the UK and the US. Indeed, research from the London School of Economics, based on interviews with 270 people who had participated in the rioting, reported on the predominant theme of inequality. No job, no money. The terms of reference in nearly every study sound the same drumbeat. Lack of opportunity, lack of access to education, marginalization, deprivation, grievance, hopelessness. And although the London riots differed substantially from other protests that preceded and followed, most notably the Indignados movement that began with a large-scale public mobilization in Madrid in May 2011, and the Occupy movement that would emerge on September 17th in Wall Street's Zuccotti Park, they shared a point of origin in the themes of economic inequality and exclusion. The U.S., the UK and most of Europe entered the second decade of the 21st century facing economic and social inequalities more extreme than anything since the Gilded Age and comparable to some of the world's poorest countries. Despite a decade of explosive digital growth that included the Apple miracle and the penetration of the internet into everyday life, dangerous social divisions suggested an even more stratified and anti-democratic future. In the age of new consensus financial policy stabilization, one U.S. economist wrote, the economy has witnessed the largest transfer of income to the top in history. A sobering 2016 report from the International Monetary Fund warned of instability, concluding that the global trends toward neoliberalism have not delivered as expected. Instead, inequality had significantly diminished the level and the durability of growth, while increasing volatility and creating permanent vulnerability to economic crisis. The quest for effective life has been driven to the breaking point under the aegis of market freedom. 2 years after the North London riots, research in the UK showed that by 2013, poverty, fueled by lack of education and unemployment, already excluded nearly a third of the population from routine social participation. Another UK report concluded, workers on low and middle incomes are experiencing the biggest decline in their living standards since reliable records began in the mid-19th century. By 2015, austerity measures had eliminated 19%, or £18 billion, from the budgets of local authorities, had forced an 8% cut in child protection spending, and had caused 150,000 pensioners to no longer enjoy access to vital services. By 2014, nearly half of the U.S. population lived in functional poverty, with the highest wage in the bottom half of earners at about $34,000. A 2012 U.S. Department of Agriculture survey showed that close to 49 million people lived in food-insecure households. In Capital in the 21st Century, the French economist Thomas Piketty integrated years of income data to derive a general law of accumulation. The rate of return on capital tends to exceed the rate of economic growth. This tendency, summarized as R is greater than G, is a dynamic that produces ever more extreme income divergence, and with it a range of anti-democratic social consequences, long predicted as harbingers of an eventual crisis of capitalism. In this context, Piketty cites the ways in which financial elites use their outsized earnings to fund a cycle of political capture that protects their interests from political challenge. Indeed, a 2015 New York Times report concluded that 158 U.S. families and their corporations provided almost half, $176 million, of all the money that was raised by both political parties in support of presidential candidates in 2016, primarily in support of Republican candidates who have pledged to pare regulations, cut taxes, and shrink entitlements. Historians, investigative journalists, economists, and political scientists have analyzed the intricate facts of a turn toward oligarchy, shining a light on the systematic campaigns of public influence and political capture that helped drive and preserve an extreme free market agenda at the expense of democracy. A précis of Piketty's extensive research may be stated simply. Capitalism should not be eaten raw. Capitalism, like sausage, is meant to be cooked by a democratic society and its institutions, because raw capitalism is antisocial. As Piketty warns, a market economy, if left to itself, contains powerful forces of divergence, which are potentially threatening to democratic societies and to the values of social justice on which they are based. Many scholars have taken to describing these new conditions as neo-feudalism, marked by the consolidation of elite wealth and power far beyond the control of ordinary people and the mechanisms of democratic consent. Piketty calls it a return to patrimonial capitalism, a reversion to a pre-modern society in which one's life chances depend upon inherited wealth rather than meritocratic achievement. We now have the tools to grasp the collision in all of its destructive complexity. What is unbearable is that economic and social inequalities have reverted to the pre-industrial feudal pattern, but that we, the people, have not. We are not illiterate peasants, serfs, or slaves. Whether middle class or marginalized, we share the collective historical condition of individualized persons with complex social experiences and opinions. We are hundreds of millions or even billions of second modernity people whom history has freed both from the once immutable facts of a destiny told at birth and from the conditions of mass society. We know ourselves to be worthy of dignity and the opportunity to live an effective life. This is existential toothpaste that, once liberated, cannot be squeezed back into the tube. Like a detonation's rippling sound waves of destruction, the reverberations of pain and anger that have come to define our era arise from this poisonous collision between inequality's facts and inequality's feelings. Back in 2011, those 270 interviews of London participants in the riots also reflected the scars of this collision. They expressed it in different ways, the report concludes, but at heart, what the rioters talked about was a pervasive sense of injustice. For some, this was economic, the lack of a job, money, or opportunity. For others, it was more broadly social, not just the absence of material things, but how they felt they were treated compared with others. The sense of being invisible was widespread. As one woman explained, the young these days need to be heard. It's got to be justice for them. And a young man reflected, when no one cares about you, you're gonna eventually make them care. You're gonna cause a disturbance. Other analyses cite the denial of dignity expressed in the wordless anger of the North London rampage. When the Occupy movement erupted on another continent far from London's beleaguered neighborhoods, it appeared to have little in common with the violent eruptions that August. The 99% that Occupy intended to represent is not marginalized. On the contrary, the very legitimacy of Occupy was its claim to supermajority status. Nevertheless, Occupy revealed a similar conflict between inequality's facts and inequality's feelings, expressed in a creatively individualized political culture that insisted on direct democracy and horizontal leadership. Some analysts concluded that it was this conflict that ultimately crippled the movement, with its inner core of leaders unwilling to compromise their highly individualized approach in favor of the strategies and tactics required for a durable mass movement. However, one thing is certain. There were no serfs in Zuccotti Park. On the contrary, as one close observer of the movement ruminated, what is different is that from the start, very large sections of we the people proved to be wiser than our rulers. We saw further and proved to have better judgment, thus reversing the traditional legitimacy of our elite governance that those in charge know better than the unwashed. This is the existential contradiction of the second modernity that defines our conditions of existence. We want to exercise control over our own lives, but everywhere that control is thwarted. Individualization has sent each one of us on the prowl for the resources we need to ensure effective life, but at each turn we are forced to do battle with an economics and politics from whose vantage point we are but ciphers. We live in the knowledge that our lives have unique value, but we are treated as invisible. As the rewards of late-stage financial capitalism slip beyond our grasp, we are left to contemplate the future in a bewilderment that erupts into violence with increasing frequency. Our expectations of psychological self-determination are the grounds upon which our dreams unfold. So the losses we experience in the slow burn of rising inequality, exclusion, pervasive competition, and degrading stratification are not only economic. They slice us to the quick in dismay and bitterness because we know ourselves to be worthy of individual dignity and the right to a life on our own terms. The deepest contradiction of our time, the social philosopher Zygmunt Bauman wrote, is the yawning gap between the right of self-assertion and the capacity to control the social settings which render such self-assertion feasible. It is from that abysmal gap that the most poisonous effluvia contaminating the lives of contemporary individuals emanate. Any new chapter in the centuries-old story of human emancipation, he insisted, must begin here. Can the instability of the second modernity give way to a new synthesis? A third modernity that transcends the collision, offering a genuine path to a flourishing and effective life for the many, not just the few? What role will information capitalism play? 5. A third modernity. Apple once launched itself into that abysmal gap. And for a time, it seemed that the company's fusion of capitalism and the digital might set a new course toward a third modernity. The promise of an advocacy-oriented digital capitalism during the first decade of our